like, okay, did I record that? No, I didn't. Awesome job. Yes. Very welcome, Patrick Ferenga. I'm very, very happy that you're here with me because I can say you had a great influence on my life just because of what you're doing with your life. And I'm very honored that you're here on my show. Very welcome.
Well, thank you, Alexandra. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice. So, okay, tell us and the listeners especially a bit more about you. I think everyone who's into unschooling, homeschooling heard at least of you and maybe is not perfectly familiar with your work, but you did a great job. I mean, you've been writing about unschooling, homeschooling. You've been actively like going out into the world and telling everyone, hey, folks, let's do it. This is how it works. Unschooled even. You unschooled your three kids, I think.
That's
so
right.
You have a real life experience. It's not all about talking. It's also about the action. Yeah, you wanted to introduce yourself a little bit and tell us what happened.
All right. Briefly, you know, my biography in unschooling is, let me see. So it's been 42 years that I've been involved in unschooling. I got started in 1981 when I volunteered at Holt Associates, the company founded by John Holt in 1977. Started off as an education consulting company, and then it quickly became a publishing company when he started the magazine Growing Without Schooling. And John, to put it in perspective, John's story was that he was a very famous teacher and author in the 1960s and early 70s who was his first book was called How Children Fail. And you described how you yourself went to like the best private schools in Germany and how that didn't satisfy you and serve your needs. Well, John Holt taught in the best private schools, well, the equivalent of high schools here and middle schools, all the elite places in Boston and in Colorado in the 1950s and early 60s. And he came to the conclusion in his first book, How Children Fail, that everything that goes on in these schools is a charade of learning, that, you know, the teachers promote the students display their knowledge on a test, and then, you know, they get promoted. And then John realized that if he gave the same test, even a couple of days later, like one on a same test that he gave on Friday, he gives on Monday, most of the students failed it, even though they passed it on Friday. And then he just realized it's like everyone just cramming, and we, the teachers, are prepping them for these things. And then once it's over, we all forget about it and move on to the next thing. And so he wanted to understand this conundrum. Why is it that I teach, but they don't learn? And so his first book was done in conjunction with a co-teacher, Bill Hull, who sat in the back of the classroom. He and John had this arrangement. You would take notes on what the students or how they're reacting to my teaching and vice versa. And those notes became the basis of his book, How Children Fail. And he essentially concluded that it's the structure of schooling. It's the way that we take a child's innate ability to learn that they're born with, that we can all observe as parents, that we see how they learn to walk and talk and socialize by exploring the world around them. But somehow we decide that we have to cut it off to give them instruction in this. And certainly children need some instruction, and they will ask for it, or if not verbally, in other ways. But in school, it's become so rigid that, you know, we just assume by age they need to know X, Y, and Z. So, for instance, in American schools, if you don't learn to read by third grade, that's a real problem, and you'll probably be going for remedial work and so on, because the whole curriculum after third grade is based on being able to read. But then you have alternative approaches, like in Germany, the Waldorf approach. They didn't, you know, children learn to read at different ages. I think for them it was when the eye teeth fall out. So late reading is not a problem for those folks, and so on for other methods of schooling that John learned about is, as you start to get outside the private school bubble, where everything is about getting your kids into the next level of education, where the whole purpose of education is to move up the ladder of education, instead of, well, how do I take this and use this information in my life, in the real world, other than climbing the meritocratic ladder to get better grades than my classmates? And so John wrote this book, How Children Learn, his second book. And that book is just celebrated. It's not just, I think 3 years ago, celebrated its 50th anniversary in print. And both those books have never gone out of print. How Children Fail came out in 64 and 1964, and Learn came out in 67. And it was those two books that really propelled John into his fame. And he became well-known as an advocate for children's rights, because as he was struggling, say, how do I get teachers in schools to accept that giving children more freedom to decide how and when and where they learn would be more beneficial than trying to control how and when they learn? And, when he realized that schools weren't going to change, and that was in the late 60s, early 70s, he came up with the idea of maybe children should have rights. So he wrote the book Escape from Childhood, The Needs and Rights of Children, where he tried to say that, basically, if we just treat children as citizens, a lot of our problems would be solved. But in the United States, that's never going to happen. Children are still pretty much the property of parents. It's really hard to get over that. And John, that book has always been a firestorm of controversy. Even today, I publish it as Holt Associates Publishing. It's kind of a toxic book for other publishers to touch. But to me, it's a very important book in John's thought. And then he wrote several other books, all searching for ways to fix schools or make schools more amenable to children's abilities to learn and exploring the world around them. Finally, John just wrote a book called Instead of Education in 1976, saying we need ways to help people do things better, not to give them better educations. And as he wrote in a letter at that time, a life worth living and work worth doing. That's what I want for all people, not just something called a better education. We're just always focused on, if only we get the right formulation of education right, everything will be right in our schools. So John called for an underground railroad at the end of Instead of Education to get children away from the compulsory effects, because he said that schools have no need to change as long as the law says children must attend schools. And even beyond that, he wrote about this in his book Freedom and Beyond, a couple of books before he wrote Instead of Education. In Freedom and Beyond, he was noting, if we only define education as schooling, we're limiting what education is tremendously, because education is so much more than schooling. But schooling eats up the budget and eats up our attention and all our interest in all other forms of learning. And so things like activity clubs, libraries, museums, learning centers, just basic public spaces where children and families can gather freely and socialize. They've all become less and less, and education is taking up more, schooling is taking up more and more time of children's time. And so John said, let's create this underground railroad. And parents immediately started writing him saying, John, you don't need an underground railroad. You can just teach your own children. And that John just jumped on that. And so he created Growing Without Schooling magazine the next year, 1977, to help put these people in touch with one another. He didn't care, as do I, that you're homeschooling for religious reasons or for secular reasons, or because your child is neurodiverse or has certain physical issues, other issues. It's just like we all want to have the right to work with our children rather than working on our children, and so. The magazine got started, and when I got there in 1981, the magazine was just starting to gain national traction. John's book, Teach Your Own, had just come out. One of my first jobs as a volunteer was to take those books out of the boxes and put them on the shelves, because that's pretty much how the magazine sustained itself, was through the sales of books that John wrote and that he recommended for helping children learn math and science and history and so on. And so in that situation, in 1981, I found myself there as a volunteer because I wanted to be a teacher. I went got my master's degree in English, and I thought I'd teach in high school, maybe a community college. But I was really looking more towards high school. And then it turned out they were not hiring teachers, they were firing teachers back in the 1980s. You know, education is a business, and its business cycle had changed in America then. And they were, you know, they've been rolling back on property taxes, and property taxes were what supported local schools. And so they were cutting back on budgets and not hiring new teachers. And at the time, and it's still true, the population of school age students is declining, and it continues to. But you know, there were, you know, there so you know, I found myself in this odd position of having a master's degree in English and working a cash register in a bookstore. And one of the cashiers there, her husband, was volunteering at Holt Associates and recommended that I do it too, because then I could learn word processing. Which was a skill that was very much in demand in the early 80s, because a word processor was a separate machine. It was not an app built into a computer at the time. Holt had an Olivetti, and he loved that thing. Had a little floppy disk like that big. I think it held 12 pages of text. but that was a big deal back then. And so I did that. And one night, I mean, John, I didn't meet John Holt till after maybe 2 months or 3 months of working there, because he was on a tour of Scandinavia. You know, this idea of homeschooling really shocked people, especially people who believed, you know, in John's ideas about alternative education. And he's like, well, how could you go into this other, you know, this other realm, this non-school realm of education? And, you know, it's like, well, if you've read John, you know, from his first book on, he recognized that schooling is not the same as education. So, you know, I found myself in this bind, you know, because John asked me, he was sitting in the book stacks the one night I happened to be there to volunteer. And so we had never met. We introduced ourselves. And he was an avid reader. So when he wasn't at work, when he wasn't home, he was at the office either reading books or writing. And so he asked me, you know, where I was from. I said New York. And then it turns out he was born in Manhattan. And so we discussed all these things. We kind of bonded around jazz and our love of big band music. And then he asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, I want to be a teacher. And he said, why? And I said, I like working with children. And John just looked me square in the eye and said, oh, Pat, you got it all wrong. If you become a teacher, you're not going to work with children. You're going to work on children. And that's when I realized, what did I get myself into? And I started to get, you know, I mean, that's not my idea of what a teacher does. And John just looked at me and says, I just finished a 3-month tour arguing with professors all across Scandinavia about this. And now, you know, have you ever read one of my books? And I said, honestly, no. And then he said, have you read anything by Ivan Illich? And I said, no, I don't even know who he was. And he said, well, read a book by him or a book by me, and then let's talk about it. I'm not going to run through all this. And then we just got talking about music again. But it really, really struck with me. And the first book I tried to read was Teach Your Own. And I just couldn't get my head around it. It just, you know, how are they going to get kids into college? Because I was just coming out of college. I was a year fresh out of graduate school. It's like, this doesn't make sense to me. And one of my colleagues at the office, Peggy Durkee, she said, she was John's longtime manager. She said, well, look, why don't you just start with this first book? Because it's all kind of a journey for him. So start with that and tell us what you think, you know. And then How Children Fail made me understand. You know, because I was that kid in the classroom who felt bored and who was just going through the motions, playing the school game, getting good grades, and just getting on with my life otherwise. I was like, okay, done with that. Now I can go play the piano. You know? And so that made a lot of sense. And from then on, I started to understand where he was coming from. But then what really made the penny drop for me was as I volunteered and worked at the office and the business was growing, and then they needed an advertising manager. So I took that role on part time. I was able to quit the bookstore, and then eventually Peggy left for another job and I became the office manager and then John's personal manager. So I really started to understand what was going on. Because John wanted to have, we always had volunteers bring their kids into the office to help. because it was very much a bootstrap operation. There's never been any organization supporting homeschooling the way John did. I mean, if we were a religious group, we probably would have had some support, but we didn't go that way. And so it was just volunteer efforts and just the sheer work that we did that we made it all come together and as profitable as we could make it. And I think it was Wednesday nights, one Wednesday of a month, we had open houses. And we were the only game in town. So people came from Maine, New Hampshire, all the neighboring states. Sometimes people would fly in to see Boston and then schedule so they could be there for one of the open houses just to meet John and the staff and show their kids the office. And as I met this incredible variety of people, you know, evangelical Christians living in communes in Vermont and hippies from California and professors from MIT, and all sorts of literary people that John knew, like George Denison and Jim Herndon, like these famous alternative school writers. Then I realized, like, this is really a big issue. This is not, John is reaching across the usual bounds of the education dialogue and trying to broaden it into like this much bigger issue. And then I really got on board. And so then the rest speaks for itself. John died in 1985. He left me the company with a board of directors to help me. And I published the magazine from 1985 after his death till 2001 for 16 years. So I published almost twice as many issues as John did himself. And the editor who I worked with the longest, Susanna Sheffer, she published 16 years of issues, far more than John did, because his life was cut short. But it's an amazing testament to the ideas that John was promoting and came up with and as he would be the first to say, he's not the first one to say these things. You know, one of his favorite books was a book called The Biography of a Baby by Millicent Shin, a physician from the turn of the century, where she describes, the first year of life of her granddaughter and how much learning takes place. But it's not a laboratory study, and it's not, and that's the sort of stuff that appealed to John, was the personal stories. And that's what we've been doing, what I've been doing ever since, is sharing people's stories, of my own, but largely other people's, because the realm of experience with homeschooling and giving your family, yourself, your children, more access and permission to access the world, to use the public sphere as your educational experience instead of the private school classroom. These are all things that led me to stay with us for the 43 years I've been involved now. Well, 42 years, 1981. So, yeah, so sorry to go on and on. That was a lot of history there.
42. That is nice. Because isn't that the answer to life, the universe, and everything? That's funny.
Why do you say that? I was wondering, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right? I forget, 42 or 46. Yeah, it was something like that. Yeah.
Nice, yes. So I wanted to ask you, how did unschooling change your lifestyle? Because from what I've been seeing is that unschooling is not just not sending your kid to school. It is way more. It goes really deep. I mean, deschooling is a huge part of it, but living an unschooling lifestyle, it taught me to really make different life choices and everything. So, what I really like is that unschooling does not necessarily mean no school at all. I really like that open approach to education, and it goes deep, I think. How about you? How did that look in your life?
Well, when I started at Holt Associates, I was a single man. I was dating the woman who became my wife, and she was very much a feminist. She was working in a political theater group and helping the national campaign to give women to pass the Equal Rights Amendment for women back in the 1980s. So she was very, very skeptical of homeschooling. A common criticism of it is, oh, it's all about, you know, trying to keep the woman at home. But, you know, what I found is that a lot, and my wife eventually realized this, a lot of these families were, you know, working to make the home a place of productive activity, a place where the husband contributes and participates in the family life. And where it's the home is not just a place where you crash after work or school, it's a meaningful haven, and that started to help my wife to understand, but also the fact that John Holt was never draconian about unschooling. You know, I mean, he just thought it was a better word than homeschooling because he didn't want you to think that, you know, you had to turn your home into a school or even do anything schoolish with your children at home. But he understood that sometimes, because this is the culture that we live in, the world culture, I mean, every society, regardless of its politics and culture, has a form of schooling, you know. So it is there, but there's a big difference when a child chooses or the family agrees that this would be the best choice now for you to go to school. So one unschooler that I met, her name is Nancy Wallace. She's no longer with us, unfortunately, but she wrote some very influential books in the early 80s, Better Than School, probably being her most famous. But Nancy often described that there was a swinging door between her home and the school. And that if her kids could give a good reason for going to school or for taking formal lessons, why not? And I agree with that. And that's what we did with our kids. Our oldest daughter wanted to go to school in sixth grade. Her best friend, who lives right next door to us. I mean, I'm in my home office now, but in the house immediately to my right is where two of my daughter's best friends grew up. And the public school that for grades 1 through 5, 1 through 6 is right across the street. I'm pointing at it now. Now it's an administrative building for Tufts University. But back in the day, it was an elementary school. And so my girls were very aware of what was going on in the school because, you know, yeah, we had a lot of unschooling friends and homeschooling friends because of my work, and that was a real boon for us. But also, we're part of this culture, you know, this Medford, Massachusetts, Cambridge, Somerville neighborhood, you know, where we all live in, and I wanted my kids to always feel part of that. They're part of society. Society is not just school, and they got that. But my oldest daughter, when her friend Heather they're both into science, and I forgot what the science experiment was. It had something to do with astronomy, and Lauren really wanted to go to school to do this with Heather, so she went to sixth grade, and I think it lasted 6 weeks or maybe 8, because as soon as they got to the assignment of, you know, now you get to choose your science project, they had to choose from the assigned projects the teacher gave, and none of them revolved around the issue that Heather and Lauren wanted to explore. And the teacher was just, sorry, it's got to be, you know, from this list. And so that was when Lauren's so pretty much after, it was probably like a semester, but I remember it was around the holidays where she decided, take me out. She never went back to school again until community college when she was 16, and then by taking community college courses, she was able to get into a 4-year college transfer when she was 18. She transferred in as a junior, so she was able to finish a 4-year college in 2 years based on the number of credits she had accumulated earlier in lieu of going to high school here. So it's, you know, it worked out in some interesting ways. And my youngest daughter probably had the most extreme experience because her best friend, Michelle, was going to the public school here. And she really didn't. she didn't want to be different than Michelle. And it was really, really painful. Audrey was so socially conscious about wanting to stay with her friends, you know. And this is the thing, I mean, with homeschooling and unschooling, it's like, you got to help your kids find friends. You know, that's an important thing. That's more important than the academics, as far as I'm concerned. But Audrey wanted to do this. So she goes into first grade, and within a week, the first grade teacher was calling us. And she said, your daughter, Audrey, can count and add up to 50 without difficulty. She knows all the letters of her alphabet, and she's, you know, showing, you know, beginning signs of learning to read. I have 24 children in my classroom, and she will be bored silly because I have so much work to do with the other kids. I think she would be better served if you homeschooled her. And just hearing that from her teacher, because she loved her. Oh gosh, she had an Italian name. I can't remember it now. But Miss, she unfortunately passed away too. But yeah, I thought that was really nice. You know, so Audrey came out and she was happy until third grade. In third grade, she wanted to go back again. So she goes in to be with Michelle for third grade, and they had this teacher that Audrey didn't like, and the teacher clearly had a. I wouldn't say had it in for Audrey, but she didn't appreciate Audrey's comments and disruptiveness. So I literally got a phone call from the principal one day saying, your daughter Audrey's in my office and she didn't, you know, she's too scared to ask you. So she asked me to ask you if she could be homeschooled again. So, you know, you can work with these things. Now, we're, like I said, we're lucky. Everything was local and nearby. I've heard and read and, you know, unfortunately even been a witness in a court case over, you know, how, you know, badly schools can treat children. But I think that, you know, the swinging door idea can work if you can make it work, because a lot of schools, I mean, I think after COVID, a lot have accepted. Reluctantly, but accepted that homeschooling can work, you know, and that it's a viable option. But, you know, it seemed like until my daughter got that approval from the school officials, she just needed, and then the other thing is she became very close friends with some other homeschoolers. And we got involved in putting on plays, the Puddle Jump Players. You know, we would rent them a theater out, put on homeschool plays. One of the moms wrote these wonderful original plays based on children's books, like Five Children in It and so on. And, so we were able to fulfill the social life aspects that they felt they were missing by not going to school that way, you know. And, you know, my middle daughter, Allison, she butted heads a lot with us. She really was much more into the social end of stuff and being involved in the neighborhood. She wasn't comfortable at home. She really, really felt that she needed to be in school with her friends, that she was missing something there. So we knew that the public school wasn't working well because, you know, some of our friends were getting in trouble there. So, you know, we said, all right, let's try an alternative school. So she and Audrey went to the alternative school. And after half a year, Audrey was like, get me out of here. We did. But Allison persisted, you know, and so Allie stayed for another year, and then she wanted to continue into the local high school, which she did, and she did poorly. But she had a great social life, right, which came back to haunt her. And then now it's interesting. So the two daughters who had the most time outside of school decided to get their four-year college degrees and succeeded in doing so. In fact, my oldest got her master's in social work even. But Allison, the one who wanted to go to school all the time and, you know, using the swinging door theory, was like, okay. She now says that she never graduated college. She hated it after 1 year. And she said, now as an adult, you know, I think she's 33. and she says that she really wishes that she continued homeschooling now. It's really odd, you know, that's hindsight, you know, what can I say? But, that's been our story. And, you know, the idea that, you know, unschooling is separate from schooling and that, you know, there's this incredible brick wall between, you know, formal education and unschooling. That wall does exist for the schools, I'm afraid, more often than not. But for us, it doesn't, you know, because even if you don't find a school, you can always find a tutor or a teacher or someone. Or, you know, now there are learning centers, you know, in places. And with the online stuff, you could just register and pay for a course to teach you anything, right? So the whole idea of this wall that divides learning from living and, you know, schooling from your family life, it's permeable now, you know, but it's still there because it's in our minds, you know, and as you said, it's taken you, you know, years to de-school yourself. And that's true for all of us. You know, I still find myself, even though all these years of working, you know, the fact that I went to conventional schools, you know, until my early 20s, you know, still like affects my thought, you know, although now I realize like there are many other ways to approach this. And that, you know, if you want to be if you want to work with, let's say, sea animals, you know, you don't have to get a degree in marine biology. You know, there are other ways to do it. You know, you can work in a nature conservancy, the Cousteau Society, study, you know, whale songs, there's, you know, coral reefs. There's a lot of different ways that you can get in. I edited a book in the 1980s by Britt Barker, a young lady who grew up on a farm in Ohio. And I think it was called Nature Watch was the name of the group. And she wrote this book about when she was 16, volunteering to tag elephant seals on the Faroe Islands off the coast of California. And what a great educational experience that was for her. And I think that you know, we reserve those sorts of experiences, you know, thinking that they're only for the wealthy and the well-to-do and stuff. But they're out there if you're willing to search for them, and you can find them. But we need more of them. And I mean, that's always been John's point. We just focus so much on the metrics of education, of schooling, that we forget that education is more than that. That you know, and there are so many different ways, you know, of living and learning that we forget that school is a very limited way, but it's our society. You know, and so it affects us. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, Illich called the book, well, he didn't name the book Deschooling Society, but that's what he meant by it. Not that we need to blow up all the schools any more than John Holt was saying, you know, get rid of schools. He's saying, all we need is to disestablish them as the norm, that, you know, there are other ways that we can learn as well. So, you know, Illich in particular and John always felt that, you know, unschooling should be viewed as a complement, not an adversary to conventional education, but conventional education just has never seen it that way.
Yeah, very true. And what I really think is that unschooling is just living. And I've been to the jungle with my kid and I saw a lot of kids just living there, and there was no school, nothing, and they weren't stupid. I mean, they were just living, thriving, and learning through living. And I really like that, because I think unschooling is the perfect example for just living whatever you need in that moment. This kind of education is provided by your surrounding, I mean, in the best case.
I think that, you know, one of the things, first of all, I appreciate everything that you brought up about, you know, children being carried all the time in the arms of different caregivers as Native peoples work. There, you know, a book that really influenced John was called The Continuum Concept by Jean Leedlaw. And that, you know, that was what he used very often as evidence of, you know, look, we know that children can learn without going to school. Look at Native societies. But then more recently, Dr. Peter Gray is written a lot, particularly in his book, Free to Learn. And in it, he talks about, you know, a lot of the research on hunter-gatherer civilizations and how children are always, you know, learning by doing, by being part of it, you know, and you know, and I think that's very important, you know, because, you know, we come from a different background, because one of the things that, you know, Illich points out is that the Industrial Revolution made the agrarian society have to change because now most of the workforce was being put into the factories. But, you know, the factories were very damaging to the adults and especially to the children. There was a lot of death and destruction of childhoods caused by modern industrialization. And so that's how the public school movement got started. You know, what do we do with these kids? So they created factories for the children to be, but they would be factories of learning. Illich called this the crown jewel of the industrial age. We figured out how to manufacture education, and this is the machinery that we put it in. An educator, philosopher named Neil Postman wrote a book called The End of Childhood. And in it, he noted, I think it came out in the late 80s, early 90s. And in it, he noted that the ages of child development were not developed by medical science doctors and medical practitioners. It was developed by the school principals who just decided that every healthy child, as they considered them at that time, should be able to learn to read by this age. There's no biological marker in us that says you're now going to learn to read or you're able to learn to read. I mean, it's nonsense. Some kids learn to read earlier and other kids learn to read later. That was certainly the experience with my three daughters. They all learn to read at different ages and through different methods. But in school, there's only one way, right? And what we've learned here in America, you talked about experimenting on children. After 20 years of teaching reading a certain way, they finally decided that it doesn't work and that they really need to be teaching more phonics. And that's something that John Holt was talking about back in the 80s, that, you know, it's not exclusively phonics or exclusively whole language. It's a mixture that children learn from what they're exposed to and how they're exposed to it. You know, I mean, if reading is an unpleasant experience to them the first few times they're read to or experience it, story time or whatever, it's going to take a while before they come back to saying, oh, I want to try that. You know, but in school, it's just like, no, it's very draconian. It's very, you know, the child must fit the curriculum. I mean, John wasn't the first to note this, but, you know, he in some of his earlier books, he used the myth of Procrustes, the Greek god who would, put you on a bed. And if you didn't fit the bed properly, he cut off your feet or your arms to make sure you did. And that's how we described education. It's the bed of Procrustes.
Yeah. I think, for example, my kid, he learned a second language before he was able to properly read or write. So this is all mixed up. And we really don't know at what time the kid is ready to learn whatever, because it's a very individual approach. And I mean, it's another human being, it's another life, it's another path to go, you know? So what I think is there are different timelines for everyone to learn whatever they need in that moment. And I think school is not really providing that space.
It really is. So the first thing I would say is time is on your side. We forget that the curriculum is based on, again, the manufacturing process. And so there's a time clock, right? And in school, they measure seat time. You know, and I forget exactly what the formulation is because, you know, it was on the tip of my tongue for many years, but I'm not helping kids get into college anymore. You know, there are plenty of resources for doing that. But I forget what it was, like 600 hours of seat time would give you a half of a Carnegie credit. And you had to get something like 20 Carnegie credits to, I mean, why? Why do we sitting in a classroom and having someone lecture to you or show you slides and movies, you know, kind of like Clockwork Orange almost, right? You know, it's like, wait a minute, you know, that's it. It's so passive, you know? And then and it's good to have clubs and to try these different ways of getting kids, but it's still this artificial environment, you know? I think the first thing that parents really have to do is reflect on, what are your children doing now? Notice how they're learning. Just notice it, appreciate it, you know? And then think like, what's your role in it, right? You're providing safety, companionship, love, support, but it is always instruction. I mean, I hear parents pick up this phrase from Maria Montessori, the teachable moment. And I don't think anyone really gets it other than perhaps a true Montessori teacher. Parents say any opportunity to lecture a child is a teachable moment. And that must be unbearable. You know, I mean, it's hard enough in school, but, you know, and for parents, too. I mean, do you really want to be, you know, oh, that's not how you hold a fork. Oh, no, that's not how you should walk. No, no, that's not how you should eat. You know, yeah, we want to show them and demonstrate and model this behavior. But to turn everything into a teachable moment, so you just got to get rid of this idea that you're a teacher, first of all. You know, the word now is facilitator. You know, it's a nice word. You facilitate them. A word that I learned way back in the 1980s was as the parent, you work as the general contractor for your child's education. You're not the person that's designing the building. You're not the person, you know, running all the machinery. You choose which people and what things you want to use and try. And if they work, great. And if not, you stop and you try something else. You know, so, I mean, it's not a problem. I mean, you know, when we were looking for music teachers for our kids, some teachers clicked and say, yeah, let's try you. And others didn't. You know, and it's okay, but you know, we just don't get that opportunity in school, right? I mean, you know, in college, you might have it somewhat if you don't like a certain professor there, maybe another professor teaching a similar course, but you know, in school, that's just the way it is. And while it's great, like, you know, I think it's good that, you know, some schools will follow, like have a teacher follow the kid through the grades too, so that they get to know each other. That could also be toxic if they don't get along. So, you know, we need to be able to have, you know, breaks and ways of making the system more flexible. So think of yourself more as a general contractor to create that flexibility in your home and in your mind. You know, and then time is on your side. So what if your kid isn't learning, you know, learning the violin when they're five, or doing computer programming when they're seven? You know, that they prefer to play with dolls or put on plays. You know, so what? Time, you know, they got their lives in front of them, and you don't know where any of this is going to go. This is the thing: is like we think of school as the salvation for our children. But, you know, as Illich wrote in Deschooling Society, we believe that schools can do what God cannot, which is manipulate others for their own salvation. You know, so many parents just think that if I send you to a good school, you'll become this moral, great person. Well, some of the greatest universities on earth have unleashed some of the most horrible people on earth. You know, there's no guarantees. You know, and so, you know, my daughter Lauren I fall back on this example because, you know, I mean, it's very personal, but, you know, I mean, so she decided, after she, I'll cut her story short. I wrote about it in my revision of Teach Your Own, which came out in 2021. But, long story short, she worked in Houston as a social worker, and during that time, she got her master's in social work through an online program at the University of California. She's like $60,000 in debt still for that degree, but that degree enabled her to move up to become an administrator within the social work system. And then she got promoted and she moved to Boston. She worked in the social work system up here for 5 years, and eventually she just gave up. She just burned out. She said, I just can't take this. And she realized that the only thing that was keeping her happy and sane was her she discovered yoga as a way to relax and exercise in Houston, and she continued it. And she in Boston, there's a really lively yoga community, and she really got involved in that. And so she said, you know, I think I want to be a yoga instructor. And long story short, she's now opening her second yoga studio, and she's been very successful for the last 5 years running her yoga studios. And it's been great. So she's still paying off her MSWs, her master's in social work degree, but that's not where she landed. Yeah. And, you know, I think of like all the lawyers or doctors who have to put in horrible, horrible graduate school hours. And then if they're not happy at the end of their, you know, when they're out there and they've been in the workforce for 5 or 10 years and they say, I don't like being a lawyer, I don't like being a doctor, at least not working under these sorts of conditions, they're trapped. You know, they're, you know, between their school loans, their home loans, their lifestyle now, you know, they feel trapped. And so, you know, we have to get out of this idea that education is the salvation of us. It's going to be, it certainly can be a help, but it's not structured that way. It's structured to create winners and losers. And that's the unfortunate reality, you know. And until we create a more equitable way of judging people besides looking at their college transcripts, which I think is coming, computers have helped as people have realized the value of certificate programs, that knowledge is changing so quick. It's the point of going to 4 years, because in 4 years, what you study would be completely different in the computer field. So, you know, there needs to be a whole rethinking of how we use schools. And that's one of the things that I appreciate about John's work. He's never, or in Illich's, they're never about tearing the school down and saying, let's change it. And since we can't change it, we don't have that influence. You know, we don't. You know, they're run, I mean, these private institutions like Harvard, they have billions of dollars. They're going to go on forever. So, you know, we're not going to be able to change them. But by showing other people other ways that education can occur, that is the importance of unschooling, of homeschooling. It used to be for private schooling, but private schooling, except for a few alternative schools, but even Waldorf and Montessori schools are becoming branded as, you know, regular schools with, you know, conventional metrics and so on. So, you know, it really is important that people show that there are other ways to live and learn. And COVID brought that home again. Like, people realized, like, oh, my kid is sitting in front of a computer, like, you know, waiting for a teacher to call on them, and it's taking the teacher 20 minutes because they're dealing with so many other issues in the class. I mean, people are slowly understanding this. But I really think that the real energy of school effort and school change is happening outside the school classroom. And that's what we have to show people, is that the more people choose other ways of learning, the more the conventional schools will have to realize, we need to, you know, we need to follow what people need and want, not what we think they need and want, you know. I'll stop there.